Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guests today are Pete Goble and Rich Flanagan. Pete is a retired nurse and currently a Buddhist healthcare chaplain. Rich is an operating department practitioner working in the NHS, specialising in anaesthetics and post-operative recovery. They're both members of the Middle Way Society, and they're here to talk today to talk about the subject of pain. Hello, Pete and Rich. Welcome to the MWS podcast again.
Hello, Barry. Hello, Rich.
Hiya, Barry. Hello, Peter.
Okay, well, maybe start with you, Rich. So what started your interest in pain?
Okay, so my interest really was came through my profession, which I started in my early 20s. So by necessity, I had to have an interest in pain, owing to the fact that certainly in my recovery role, my job is largely to try and alleviate people's pain following surgery with, as we're trained, really with medications primarily. And it sort of continued through the 15 years that I've been working in that role.
Okay. What about you, Pete?
Well, my interest in pain is sort of threefold. I'm interested in my own experience of pain. I'm interested in my experience as a nurse in helping other people to cope with the problem of pain that they're experiencing. And I'm also interested in the way I bring assumptions I make about what causes pain and how it can be alleviated in a professional sense to my personal life. Because I often find that the things I recommend or attempt with other people, I can't really apply very easily to myself or to people in my personal sphere. Another thing that interests me is I've worked quite a lot in Africa, and I was very struck when working out there by the fact that African people don't seem to experience pain in the same way that that people in the Northern Hemisphere do, or that they cope with it a lot better. Right. That they're less handicapped by the experience of pain, less diverted from, you know, normal habits of like living and things like this than people in the Northern Hemisphere. In other words, they're not pussies like we are. I couldn't quite understand that. There are theories about that, but I couldn't get my head around what was going on.
Could it be that rather than, I mean, I think there was a time in the past that there were certain assumptions from Western science that Africans had a lower pain threshold in a sort of physiological sense. But I mean, and that has been debunked now. But
yeah.
Is it more to do with the idea that possibly they are more integrated in a certain way, potentially?
That could be the case, although I'm still coming to terms with what I understand the word integrated to mean. But yes, they have some different, either have some different perspective on pain or some different experience of pain. It's either affected by the sort of culture that they're brought up in or something else. And that interested me. And that interest has been supported by and encouraged by my experiences of the Middle Way philosophy.
Okay. Well, we could come back to that later, yeah. But maybe one of the first things might be interesting to explore this idea of assumptions and perception. So how do people perceive pain differently, and what assumptions do they make about pain?
Okay. In my experience, I think people tend to assume that pain is purely a physical manifestation of something, either a disease or a trauma or something like that. And they also have assumptions about what to expect from pain, certainly if they're going into surgery, so that they'll come to the surgery with assumptions, either that they're going to wake up pain-free or that they're going to be in vast amounts of pain and it's going to be you know, horrendous and terrible. And all of those assumptions, I think, lead to problems. The first one, obviously, so assuming that pain is just a physical thing is negating the fact that actually, in my experience, and I think a lot of the evidence also demonstrates, there's a very strong emotional and psychological aspect to pain, and is very closely interlinked. And what a lot of the current literature says, and what I have found in my own practice, is people who are very, very anxious, certainly in an operation setting, if they're very anxious before they've gone into surgery, there's a high chance, anecdotally from my experience, that they will wake up with more pain than someone who comes down fairly relaxed and you know, relatively chilled out within the, in the situation. And again, I think this has been echoed in the British Pain Society and in the NHS's own literature, that anxiety, depression, anger all make the experience of pain worse. So there's a very strong psychological aspect. On the other side to that, positive emotions, so people who feel positive and happy in the same situation with the same stimulus will experience the pain less. I think, yeah. I don't know if Peter's experienced the same thing either with himself or...
I do. I agree with it. And I think a lot has to do with the language you use. I mean, you were talking about people being happy and relaxed, and people, and then there is a well-established, a well-buttressed set of assumptions in Western society about psychology. What's psychological and what's physical? I mean, you don't have to be highly educated or particularly sophisticated in your thinking to know that the psychology of being and the physical side of being are different entities. But that doesn't occur in the same way in African society. This idea that we have a psychological side and a physical side and are somehow in balance or not in balance is not present in the psyche of most African people. They don't grow up with those assumptions, so there's more of a totality, more of an integrated approach to understanding the experience of pain than there is in our own society. You know, I mean, one of the first questions that comes up in the minds of people who experience pain in this country is, what's the matter with me? You know, there must be something wrong. There must be something wrong. And that is framed in terms of their understanding of medicine. You know, I'll go to the doctor and the doctor will know what to do, what's causing it, and he'll know what to give me to take the pain away. Now, that experience doesn't come in the same form to people in African society, probably not in other non-Western societies either. Yeah. I think you've already put your finger on this, Rich. There is a way of thinking about pain that's entrenched in us, and that's the way that those assumptions built into that are the things that we need to be able to challenge. The question is, how can we challenge those assumptions? How can we challenge that way of thinking? Yeah.
I think we're almost victims of our own success, really. Certainly in the sort of the Western world, I think our healthcare is so good, and a lot of the medications are so good that actually we do relieve a lot of pain, and we relieve it very effectively. So people are used to being comfortable. Well, I think our natural state is probably not to be that comfortable. I think maybe in Africa, they don't have a lot of the medications, and I think they're used to seeing people in pain, relatives in pain. They're used to experiencing it themselves. And so it's more of a day-to-day thing. It's not something that's abnormal or to be afraid of. Whereas we're so comfortable all the time that when we are faced with a situation, certainly where we're anticipating pain, it causes a great deal of anxiety, a great deal of fear. And that has this vicious circle where actually it makes the whole experience, it makes the pain worse than it would have been if we didn't have that anxiety and fear. And you mentioned sort of, what do we do to go forward with that? How do we tackle it? And certainly the NHS, I think, is making some roads into this. And actually they're now saying to people with chronic pain, Now, obviously, this is a frustrating situation. So the medical practitioner, the doctor, the pain specialist wants to stop the pain. The patient wants the pain to be stopped. And when you get in a situation where that doesn't happen, either because we don't know what the cause is, or it is that there's a large psychosomatic element to it, that causes a lot of frustration and there's a deadlock. What seems to be the thinking now is actually teaching people to accept their pain and to live with it rather than trying to fight it or cure it.
Yeah, it's interesting that you said that the better we get at finding ways of relieving pain, the more people expect their pain to be relieved, yeah. And pain has become an issue. The pain has become an issue where it's a question of people rushing to meet people's expectations and people's expectations rushing to outstrip what's available.
Yeah.
And that's a sort of the snake is eating its own tail. You know?
Exactly. Yes.
That sort of situation. It's interesting. The thought occurs to me about pain that the older people get, the more they seem able to tolerate pain than when they were younger. And whether that's because we learn that pain does subside, you know, that we can find ways of dealing with pain that don't require us to go and see the doctor or take a pill. And, you know, that's occurred to me because I've quite a lot of experience of working with older people. And older people do seem to be able to tolerate pain better, whether that's because with maturity and with the growth of wisdom, they take a different perspective on it, you know. I don't know, but it's an interesting idea.
Yeah. I think there could be a similar thing going on there as with people in Africa or people in societies that don't have very advanced healthcare, is that as people get older, they naturally experience more pain in their day-to-day lives, and so again it becomes something more normal. It becomes part of life, whereas someone who's very young probably has never experienced a great deal of pain a lot of the time. You know, they maybe had a few episodes of acute pain, but it's not something they've ever got used to. So I think that might be happening. In my career, it's often put, in my field, in my circle, it's often put down to being a sort of a generational thing. So, the Stoic wartime generation, and that's the assumption that's made. I'm not sure that's always right. I think it may be just actually as we get older, we become better equipped at dealing with it because we have to face it on a more regular basis. The thing I would say is actually, even within the older demographic, if someone comes to theatre for a hip replacement, for example, if they're either very anxious or they're expecting to wake up pain-free, often once they get through to the recovery period, they have a very difficult time, very hard time of coping with the pain, if there is any there. Patients who are expecting a little bit of pain and are relatively comfortable with that idea tend to wake up not pain-free, but certainly with a lot less anxiety and a lot less stress. And you find that all through the generations, from young right through to the very old.
It's interesting that a lot of our focus in this discussion has been on physical pain. I remember that you, Barry, in discussion earlier when we were talking about pain, you talked about the pain of loss, you know, about it's a psychic or spiritual pain, which there isn't any special word for spiritual or psychic or mental pain, you know, the anguish of losing someone or, you know, of a broken romance or things like this. And we use the word pain to describe both physical pain, which can be a symptom of some physical damage in the tissues or some anomaly in the tissues, but we use the same word for psychic pain or spiritual pain as if the two things were the same. And it would be useful perhaps to explore what difference there is perhaps between physical pain and psychological, in quotes, psychological or psychic pain. Yeah.
I think they can be very closely very, very closely linked. The experience, you know, the examples I've been talking about, the anguish people feel before an operation or after as a result of an anticipation of pain or the experience of it is psychic pain, but, you know, so that's happening as well. And my role, increasingly as the years have gone, have seen it, is to try my best to alleviate that psychological pain, almost certainly to the same degree as the physical pain, because I think it's as important, and I think the effects are just as important and valid. And I think you can't have good pain relief without dealing with the psychic aspect of it. Mm.
But setting aside the psychological, there can be psychological correlates or mental correlates to physical pain. What about psychic pain or spiritual pain as an entity in itself? Because I was listening to a program this morning on the radio where there was a woman talking about the breakdown in the mental health services, you know, the shortages and the lack of access to people who can help somebody with when they're facing a crisis. And they'd often describe it, you know, I was calling out for help because I was suffering so much. You know, I needed somebody to assuage the pain and the pain I was experiencing, of my mental disorder, my depression or my phobias or my anxieties or whatever. And there was nobody there to help me. Nobody could offer anything to help me. Now, the reaction of many people is, whatever is she whinging about? You know, yeah. There's nothing physically the matter with her. You know, she hasn't got a broken leg, or she hasn't got cancer, or she hasn't got a tumor in the brain or whatever. She's just whinging. She's talking about something that nobody can see. There's no physical cause for this. You know, why can't she pull herself up by her bootstraps and stop moaning? And yet, I know, both from personal experience and from working in mental health myself, that psychic pain or psychological pain, you know, the pain of loss, the anguish of uncertainty and things like this, is just as serious, just as debilitating, just as disabling as physical pain.
Physically. One thing that I've actually had confirmed in the last few years since I've had a regular meditation practice is that I notice whenever I experience psychic pain, it's always accompanied with physical. I don't think I would actually be able to experience psychic pain without its physicality. And I'm sure people experience it in different ways, that physicality. For me personally, when I'm feeling anxious, for example, it's a constriction in my chest and a tightness, or and often and a tension in my body, you know, and I often notice that my teeth are clenched. Now, I don't know if I can imagine psychic pain without its manifestation in my body.
Well, I think Barry's made a good point there, in that I think it's very difficult to, in any example of pain, to separate the physical and the psychic. I mean, the causes may be different. There may be a physical cause, or there may be an emotional, psychological cause, but I think the experience is always both physical and mental. As I was reading through some stuff earlier today, and was looking at the British Pain Society, they're talking about the experience of pain. And something they say is that pain is never just in the mind or just in the body. It's a complex mix involving our whole being and how our brain makes interpretations of the signals that it gets. And I think that applies as much to psychological, mental pain as it does to physical pain. I don't know about you, Peter.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I think it might be professionally useful, or it might be sort of ideologically useful to conflate what people express as physical pain and psychological pain, and say that they're basically the same, except that they're viewed from different perspectives. But I'm not entirely true that chimes in with my own experience of pain, or my experience of people I've been close to who are experiencing sort of psychic pain, because physical pain does tend to influence the way people behave, you know, their gross behaviour or sometimes their more localised behaviour. For example, you know, I've worked a lot with people with psychosis, and people with psychosis tend to pace a lot. They tend to walk up and down a lot, or sometimes they walk in small circles, you know. Sometimes they do a lot of jigging, you know, jigging the legs or jigging the arms or holding the arms in stiff positions. Now, what that represents about their experience of what I would call pain or what they call pain, I don't know. But it doesn't seem to me to bear a lot of similarity to the sort of pain that you're talking about, like the lump in the throat or the constriction in the chest. Or the pain in the back and things like this that people sometimes associate with mental anguish or depression or whatever.
Yeah.
I think to try to conflate the two and say that they're both given the same name, or people both call them pain, but whether they are in fact the same category of experience, I don't know. I think it would be a bit presumptuous to say that they are both the same but different. Different expressions of the same phenomenon.
Yeah, I'd agree with that actually. Certainly, I wouldn't say that every experience of pain is the same. You know, if you stub your toe on the bed, it's very different to if you're suffering from severe anxiety. I think what I was trying to say is that in every instance of pain, whether it's psychological or physical, so with the physical, there's always a psychological element that can, you know, be understood better, and that can help with the experience of the physical pain. And again, I think with the psychological pain, I think there's always a physical element or a physical manifestation of that again can be, hopefully, can in most cases be better understood and can be used in conjunction with just treating psychic causes. So I'm not saying they're the same thing. I'm just saying that every instance of pain has got both a psychological and a physical element to it. Those elements are different, and those elements are experienced in different ways.
Yeah, I tend to deviate slightly from that point of view, because that tends to suggest that physical pain is either mitigated or exaggerated by psychological influences or psychological components. I'm not so sure that psychological pain, as I seem to understand it, or think I understand it, is necessarily influenced by physical correlates in the same way. So there's a tendency to superimpose, if you like, or superimpose a psychological component on the experience of physical pain, but not the other way around. You see what I mean?
So yeah, sort of. Yeah, I think certainly
what they describe as anguish. As anguish, it might be the anguish of not being able to open the door and go outside. You know, people have an experience which doesn't allow them to step outside the door. They can't rationalize it or explain it, but they just can't go through the door and go outside and face the outside. Now that. They often call that pain. Can't you see I'm in pain? I'm in pain over this. Now, is there a physical component to that? Is there a physical component? Is there something operating in them physically that's influencing them so that they experience that pain of not being able to go out? In the same way that you could say a person who's got a fractured hip is influenced by the expectation that if they try to walk, it'll cause them pain. I don't know. I can't see that the two. There's a reciprocity in those two situations. In the way
I think. Yeah. So with the example you've just given about someone who's obviously anxious to leave their house, I mean my personal experience of anxiety and panic attacks, which have often led me to flee certain social scenarios in the past. It always started with certain thoughts, anxieties, but it always accumulated in a physical thing. And it was the physicality of it that would cause me to leave, with the increased heart rate. My mouth would go dry. I'd be unable to speak. my vision would change, I'd start sweating, and that would compound what was happening in my head. So I would end up in a cycle. Now, that's only my experience, but I would hazard a, I'd be comfortable in guessing that I think a lot of certainly anxiety-based sort of psychological problems have a strong physical element.
Have a physical element, but do they have a primary physical cause in the same way that one would suggest that sometimes physical pain has a...
Not always, no. But I think that you can say the same for physical pain, and certainly for conditions like IBS or a lot of chronic back pain, quite often there is a psychological thing that has caused that, and this is increasingly being explored both in the mental health field and in the sort of more medicalized field, where they've been trying to treat this pain purely as a physical ailment and failing because they don't find a cause. Quite often they found that there are underlying traumas that these people may have had in the past that have triggered off, either has triggered off the pain or has made the has somehow made the body continue a pain that they had originally had. So I think every instance is different. So I'm certainly not trying to pigeonhole every experience as pain as the same thing. Yeah.
It's interesting, and this is where I think it's worth referring to the influence of the middle way on my own thinking about phenomena like experiences like pain. Because coming from, as you do, Rich, from some sort of a clinical background, you know, there is clinical background presupposes a very powerful ideology, a certain framework of assumptions that frame every decision that's taken and every experience that's explored and analysed. And the middle way has helped me to have a different take on that, because I've always found throughout my career that I'm sometimes trying to wrestle with two frameworks for understanding suffering and ill health and recovery and things like that, one of which is the dominant medical model, you know, the clinical evidence-based model, and the other is the more right-brain model, which doesn't take as its starting point, physical phenomena and tissue breakdown and biochemical disturbances and so on. I think what I've come to realise is you don't have to experience too much conflict about these two different ways of looking at the world and looking at suffering and looking at ill health and looking at the causes of ill health. It's possible to hold them both in some sort of tension, but in a sort of creative tension. But that isn't encouraged. I think you might agree with me that isn't encouraged these days in the medical or clinical paradigm. It isn't. There's a move. I sense that there's a constant move away from anything that isn't evidence based. Anything that is sort of more holistic or integrated. There's a tendency to move away from that, or perhaps sometimes to reframe intuitive responses to suffering and ill health in clinical terms. You know, in terms of brain chemistry or brain imaging and so on. Anyway, I don't know.
Yeah, I think certainly in the early part of my career, that was very much the case, where there was a very dogmatic view of pain and as just a physical thing that just needed to be treated in a very medicalized fashion. But I feel, to me, I feel that's changing, and I think it's certainly changing for the better. Mm. Certainly within the NHS, I mean, you mentioned about evidence-based, and I would, again, this is my background, I think that everything we use should be evidence-based. It depends on what you mean by that. I don't think evidence-based doesn't mean we have to understand everything about how something works. So it could be acupuncture, it could be meditation. Even a lot of the medicines we use, we don't fully understand how they work. I think evidence-based is only to suggest that there's a good chance that they will work and they'll be safe. And I think in that, evidence-based is probably quite important. You know, we want things to be safe, and we don't want to you know, start doing things to people that either could be harmful or just won't work.
Yeah.
So I think the evidence-based model can stand and still utilize integrated practices and sort of more holistic approaches. I printed off something again from the NHS. It was a pain toolkit. And so tool number one is, first of all, just accept that this is for chronic pain. So accept that you have persistent pain and then begin to move on. So already it's moving away from the, you know, find it,
and erase it.
Isolate it, treat it.
Yeah, isolate it.
And then, you know, then it goes on to at the end. So tool number, the last two tools, tool six and seven, is be patient with yourself. You don't expect things to happen instantly. And again, this goes back to what we were saying about assumptions, both from the practitioner and from the patient. And then tool seven, which is the very last one, is learn relaxation skills. So this could be meditation, dancing, walking, reading a book, listening to music, gardening. And I think this is a big shift forward from for the medical way of looking at things. There are certainly still practitioners who wouldn't go in for this.
Mm.
I think there's a lot, but I think the fact that this stuff is being published and is being you know, given to patients as advice, I think is a good step forward.
Mm. That's a very positive and hopeful observation. I wish the same were true in the sphere of mental health, where I think the there's a countervailing influence in mental health, where mental pain and mental disturbances and the expression of the experience of people with major psychoses is being criminalized, you know, to a large extent. That shows that there is an ambivalence about evidence. There is an ambivalence in medicine about issues that are refractory, that don't respond to conventional ways of evidencing and treating mental disorders. But that's another subject altogether.
Sure. Okay, Rich. Now, Pete has mentioned the middle way in relation to pain and his understanding of it and how we can deal with it. What about you? How do you understand the middle way in relation to pain?
Okay, I mean, it's a tricky one for me. And like Peter, a lot of the terms I'm often struggle to really get to grips with and quite often slip up with my interpretation of them. But I think certainly the middle way approach has helped me structure the way I look at pain as an all-encompassing phenomenon, certainly as an embodied experience. And I think that's actually what we've been talking about a lot over the last half hour or so, is pain as an embodied experience that is best understood in those terms and is best managed in those terms. We talked about meditation, dancing, reading a book as a way to tackle physical pain. And I think that ties in very much with the middle way sort of philosophy. And also the middle way philosophy can be used as a framework to understand that the cycle people get in with pain, especially with chronic pain. So your belief may be that pain is bad and should be avoided at all costs. The meaning then comes out in anxiety, fear. You know, this is something to be scared of. The meaning is an embodied experience of anxiety or fear. And then the desire goes back to the belief, which is the desire is to avoid pain, which is something that we can't do all the time. We have to be able to accept it. And when we find out that we can't avoid the pain, we end up back at the very start of that whole cycle, going back to the anxiety and fear, back to the desire to avoid it. And to me, I mean, that sort of encapsulates the whole issue and is breaking that cycle. Probably at the belief stage. We need to change the very core belief about what pain is and what it means.
What about you, Pete? What are your thoughts on what Rich has just said?
Well, I entirely endorse what you said, Rich. What I notice is in my discussions with you and with Barry this evening, I've noticed how I tend, under pressure of discussion and debate, to retreat into well-pegged out positions that I've always held. And it's very difficult to escape them. But the middle way does provide some opportunity, some structure to do that, you know, to be open to opinions which are strange and new and experiences which are strange and new, and to approach them in an open-minded way without, as far as possible, without retreating into well-ingrained, well-entrenched ideologies and absolutisms that are not appropriate to the ever-changing and inscrutable world we live in. So I'm professionally, personally, and in all senses, grateful to the opportunity I've had to study the middle way and to experience it and discuss it in this context with people like yourselves.
Yeah. Great. And any recommendations?
For anyone that's interested in furthering the understanding of pain from a personal perspective or from a point of view of medical treatment, etc., there's a very good book called Pain. It's edited by Frederick Toates, T-O-A-T-E-S, and it's the Oxford University Press. It's published in the Open University series of books. Yeah.
Great. Is there anything you would recommend, Rich?
No, apart from the references I've made during the podcast here, that would be it really. I think there's a lot of great stuff online, and I mean I would say this, but I think the NHS is a great resource and has some great links for people who are experiencing pain, either psychological or physical.
I mentioned that, yeah.
For people in the UK, probably. I mean, yes, there's probably a word.
Well, thank you both for your ideas, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Great, thanks, Barry. Thank you, Pete.
Thank you both.
Okay.
All we need now is a bottle of port. Sit with the sit. Yeah. Bottle of port and a bowl of Balti snacks.
Yeah.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.